I call your attention this morning to Daniel. Daniel 5 is where we will be this morning. The title of the message today is Strange Words at a Party. Now, I have never really been a partier. I mean, I go to parties, but Debbie and I have a reputation of being the last ones to arrive and the first ones to leave. But some people, they just, man, they party hardy. And there's one of those that we're going to look at this morning. But it is a time that is a time that is dangerous, but yet they are so secure in themselves that they have no fear until one thing happens. Now, I will get into it, but basically, I want you to remember this background. I want you to remember that Babylon is an old, old, old city. It was begun by a man named Nimrod. Now, whenever we say, man, you're just a Nimrod, it means something that, you know, is not a flattering comment. But Nimrod was a mighty hunter. Some people think that that meant that he even hunted people. But that's when it began, probably almost 5,000 years ago. And so as time went on, it would move from this group to this group to this group. But the one that really put it on the map was a man named Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of what Daniel describes as the first world great empire. When you read through the early chapters of Daniel, you'll find that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. Nobody could figure out what the interpretation was. But Daniel is a young man that had been taken into captivity. Because you see, Babylon had come against the nation of Judah. And they conquered Judah. They did it three different times. But in that first conquering, it happened in 605 BC. Nebuchadnezzar had some of the choice young men and probably choice young women from Israel, and they were taken back to what we know today as modern-day Iraq. And they were there, and they were to be fed, those that were the choicest of the group, the Daniels, the Shadrachs, the Meshach, the Abednegoes. Those were the ones that were supposed to be there in the king's palace. They were the good-looking ones, all right? For lack of a better way to describe it, you know, they were in the upper echelon when it came to intelligence and when it came to their physical physique. And so you have these young men, and they are going to be fed with the king's menu. Daniel says, would it be okay if we not eat that? Because he knew that it had been meat that had been offered to idols. And so he made a deal with the man that was in charge, and he said, let's just do an experiment. Let me and my friends eat vegetables, and you feed everybody else whatever you want, and then look at us in a few days and see if everything's okay. And Daniel, he was better looking than the rest of them. He was healthier than the rest of them. And so they let him do that. He's about a 16-year-old kid at that time. And so you've got him, and he is in Babylon during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and Neb has a dream. Well, in that dream, you find that there is a huge statue. Babylon is a part of it. That's the golden head. Then you've got the chest and arms, the Medes, the Persians. Then you've got the thighs, which are the Greeks and Alexander the Great. Then you've got the legs and the feet. That's the Romans. Then you've got the feet, the iron mixed with clay with the 10 toes, and that's prophetic. I'm not preaching on Daniel chapter 2 today, but I'm giving you the background. Because you've got Babylon the Great, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, was in Babylon, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. It had gone down in the annals of antiquity to be one of the greatest seven things that anyone could ever lay their eyes upon. I have no idea what it looks like. I haven't been around since, I've only been here since 56. I haven't been around, you know, since Nebuchadnezzar's time 2,500 years ago. And so you've got this city, though, and we read about it. And we see the grandeur of it. And I spent a little time this week just looking at Babylon images on my computer. And how that you'd have artist renditions of it. And some of them would have the greenery that would be hanging. And I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, you know, that has to be a marvel in that ancient time. It would be something today if we saw it, but even in that ancient time, it would certainly be something. And I think about how that nobody really was praised the way that Nebuchadnezzar was. But Nebuchadnezzar died. If you go to the next slide, what we'll see is we'll see some things that the city was about 53 miles around it. Now, I don't know. I've never clocked it. I had a friend of mine. I say he's a friend of mine. He was a roommate in college. He was different. Sometimes he would get a little antsy. And when he would get really nervous, and I mean, he would have something weighed on his mind, he'd go get in his car and drive around 285 and smoke a pack of cigarettes. That was the way that he was able to try to calm himself down. Now, I've never measured around the perimeter, but I've been told that it is 65 miles. Babylon was 53 miles. So you imagine if you were to go down 78, get on Stone Mountain Freeway, hit 285, going right toward Greenville, drive all the way around, up past 75 exit, drive on around, cross over Interstate 20, come on down near the airport, come back around, going toward like Augusta, come on back up, and then you would go 65 miles. This city in ancient times, about 53, according to the footprint that some archaeologists have said. They think this is the basic outline of the city. The walls, 21 feet thick. Now, if you've ever been to Fort Pulaski in Savannah, that's a Civil War fort. The walls, the bricks are massive. But I don't think there's a 21-footer in the mix. Now, it's been years since I've been to Pulaski, but I know that you can still see where that the shells would hit it. But I don't think there's a 21-foot thick wall there. I know that there is not a 90 to 320-foot wall up. I know that. But yet that's how high Babylon the Great walls were. The minimum would have been about 90. The maximum would have been about 320. Do you realize that at the height of one of those walls, it was longer than a football field? If you were to take a football field and turn it up on its end, they had walls that were taller. Is there any wonder that they felt secure? Is it any wonder that they thought, we're invincible? As a matter of fact, at this particular time, there were an army around the outside of the place, and they weren't worried about it. Why? The Euphrates River ran right underneath the walls, and it had huge bronze gates that were there. They had a 20-year food supply. They didn't care what went on outside because their walls were high. Their army was supposedly strong. And so they were living a lavish lifestyle. When you think about them, you think, yeah, they were the first world empire. But can I tell you that all men die? Everybody dies. I know there's some people years ago back in the 80s, they tried cryogenics, where they would say, now what we're going to do is we're going to freeze dry you real quick right before you pass. And then in the future, when there's a cure, we're going to thaw you out and we're going to cure you and you're going to have immortality. There are billionaires that still try that kind of stuff today. They want to hold on to every extra day that they possibly can. You know why? Because we're all hardwired to live. None of us really want to die unless we've got maybe something that's going on mentally. We want to live. It's part of our DNA. These guys thought that they were just going to continue and continue and continue. But Nebuchadnezzar dies. Well, there's a couple of quick guys that are there. They lasted a short time. One of them, and it's a weird old name, Evil Murdoch. It's his name, Evil Murdoch. Evil is spelled E-V-E-L, not E-V-I-L. Well, he dies quick. Then there's another guy that lasted about 2 months. But Nebuchadnezzar is followed by a son of his named Nabonidus. Nabonidus, he doesn't really want to be at Babylon. This guy likes to travel. He likes to go and research things. Some people have called this guy the first archaeologist. He didn't want to be stuck at Babylon. He wants to be out. And so what he does is he gives his son Belshazzar, not to be confused with Belt-Shazzar, with the T. That's the name that they gave to Daniel. But Belshazzar is now in charge. Now, I want you to take your Bible. If you have a pen, I want you to write right between the end of chapter 4, verse 37, and the beginning of chapter 5, verse 1. I want you to write 70. The reason for that is because we're about 70 years down the road now. Nebuchadnezzar dies in 562, but now 539, and so you do the math on that. What is that? Maybe it's not 70. Maybe it's like 20 or 30. I hadn't got my phone out, so I can't do it with my calculator. So anyway, when he dies, Nabonidus takes over. He doesn't like it. He's going to go archaeology hunting. He's got Belshazzar. For years, liberal theologians would make this statement. You know the book of Daniel is not true. There has never been anybody that sat on the throne of Babylon named Belshazzar. Problem is, the rocks cry out. There's an archaeological dig. And if you go to the next slide, what you'll see is you will see a cylinder that is called the Nabonidus cylinder, or Nabonidus cylinder. And I can't even say it. Nabonidus cylinder. I want to call it a stone, but it's a cylinder. That right there is how they would record. They didn't have the cloud yet. They didn't have hard drives and external hard drives. They didn't even have notebooks with ledgers that you could write in. This is how they did it. They would take a cylinder such as this, and someone with a sharp stylus would write in the Babylonian language, which was Chaldean, and they would write the things that was going on. And from the time that Nabonidus took over for Nebuchadnezzar until Babylon fell, that's on that cylinder right there. And one of the things that is on that cylinder is this. Belshazzar was his co-regent. That means that he ruled at the same time. So he left Belshazzar, his son, back in Babylon while Nabonidus was out excavating. Look at chapter 5, verse 16. In chapter 5, verse 16, it says, "And I have heard of thee, and thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. And if thou canst read the writing, what are you going to do? I'm going to make you," the last phrase says, "the third ruler in the kingdom." You know why he couldn't make him the second? You remember in Egypt, when Joseph interpreted Pharaoh's dream, he made him number two. Belshazzar could not make him number two. There was already two. They had his dad, Nabonidus, and they had him. So he said, "I'm going to make you number three." The accuracy of the Bible is always a beautiful thing. And so you've got Belshazzar. Now, what are we seeing? Go with me to back to verse number one of chapter five. And I'm going to hurry. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords. All I think about when I see this is I think about how that they had a huge palace area where there could be huge soirees. And all I'm thinking is that's what's happening at where the east wing of the White House is right now. That's what I'm thinking right now. The president is trying to have this, and you know who's going to be there? I guarantee you it's not going to be some hillbilly from somewhere in Podunk, Tennessee. It's going to be the movers and the shakers. That's who's going to be there. Why? Because they want to show themselves. They want to be near the levers of power, so to speak. And you've got 1,000 of these lords. You've got these people, and what are they doing? Man, they're partying. Some people have estimated that this party had gone on for 6 months. But can I tell you, after a while, the pleasures of sin begin to wear off and you got to have something better and bigger. I mean, you know, after a while, one drink don't cut it, you got to have two. After a while, one affair doesn't cut it, you got to have two. After a while, pretty soon, you know, that thrill is, you know, it takes a little bit more to get you, you know, get you all buzzed. And what you got is you got these parties that's been going on, and he goes, "I got an idea. I tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go back to where we keep all of those sacred things that my grandfather had captured when he conquered Judah. And they took all of the gold and they took all of the silver and all of those golden cups and the goblets and the pitchers, and they began to pour their wine into those things. And they said, 'Hey, we'll make the gods of Babylon greater than the gods of Judah.'" So they took it and they began to drink out of it and they began to mock it. And so it wasn't just some type of sensual party that was going on, it turned into something that became sacrilegious. God was being mocked with their indulgence, and God was being marked or mocked by the fact that they thought that they were invincible. They were indifferent to everything that was happening outside of the walls. You've got Darius the Medes outside. They didn't care. Why? Because they have a 20-year supply of food. They've got unending water coming through with the Euphrates. They have got the high walls. They have got their armies that can shoot down on the enemy. They have got it all together, so they think. You know, I've been preaching off and on for the last 3 or 4 weeks about our 250th birthday for our country. There has never been a military in the history of the world. I'm talking about Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. I'm talking about Cyrus's Persians. I'm talking about Alexander the Great's Grecians. I'm talking about the Romans with men like Julius Caesar, those types of men. There has never been a fighting force with as much lethal power as we have in our nation. And all I think is, how many of those goobers in Washington, probably haven't heard a preacher use that word goober in a long time. How many of those fellows in Washington think that because we have so many airplanes and we have so many ships and we have so much artillery and we have so many munitions that we're good? Do we not understand that God could take us down at any moment? And yet, what do we see from the halls of Congress and the halls of the White House, yea, even the halls of the judiciary? What do we see? Arrogance? Pridefulness? We don't find people having prayer meetings, at least we don't know about them. We don't have leaders that are what I would call righteous, but yet righteousness exalts a nation. I pray to God that we will become a righteous nation once again. But I know this, every time the name Jesus is mentioned, somebody goes ballistic. Do you pick up on that? I'm telling you, hey, there's people that are being bounced out of professional leagues that are athletes. Why? Because they dared to name the name of Christ. There being people being ripped. There was a pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers that would not support Pride Day. I mean, he is getting ripped from Dan to Beersheba. And you've got anybody that takes a stand, and sometimes they crawdad and change their minds. But they ought not, because they're on God's side. And so there's sacrilege that's going on. Number two, I want you to see the strange words, and hence the title of the message today, Strange Words on a Wall. Now you imagine this. You've got the four walls of that magnificent party room. You've got a blue wall and another blue wall and a blue wall. And there's all types of tile and all types of drawings and all types of beauty. And then on the very back wall, it is white plaster. And it offsets the blues. There's a stage, and that's where Belshazzar and many of his lords, maybe some of the women, they're all raised up, just like I'm standing on a platform. There would have been a platform there. But yet, at a split second of a moment, they see a finger that appears. And it begins to write on that wall right behind where he would have been sitting. And one by one, they began to go, what's that noise? And they hear it being etched into that plaster. And they turn and they look. And there are some words that are there. Those words, we'll get to them in a moment, are likely in what we would say Aramaic. I've heard some people and they think that it was written maybe in Hebrew. I personally think the Aramaic, but they think it was written in Hebrew. But I know this, it could have been that it was written the way that Hebrew is written, because there's nobody that can understand it. Not a single one of the lords, the upper echelon of the intelligentsia, not a single one of them could understand it. And so maybe it was written from right to left like the Hebrews write. Now we write from left to right. And to be honest with you, whenever I see someone that is writing in a Jewish style, you know, it confuses me for a moment until I can get my bearings right and go, oh, okay, I got to read it from this direction, because we were always left to right, not right to left. And so they're looking at these words, And they're going, I don't know what that means. Wonder what that means. I thought you might have an idea. I mean, you're with the Department of Education. You ought to know. I don't know. And the king doesn't know. And what does it say? It tells us that his knees begin to shake. He begins to get scared. He doesn't understand this. It's different. And now he is afraid. Now that's probably the first sane thing that he's done in a while. To be afraid at a time like this. And so it could be that the natural man doesn't receive the things of the Lord. That's what Paul told the Corinthians. And so you've got this group of people. They have been partying hard. I mean, the liquor's been flowing. The girls have been dancing. I mean, they have had just a great old time. But now they have performed that great sacrilege of taking the holy vessels that have been sanctified for God, and they have debauched them. And so these words appear on the wall. Now, the third thing we'll see this morning is we'll see a summons for the prophet. And I want you to notice that I have italicized on your screen there the little word "the," because there are no more prophets that we read about in Babylon. There aren't any. Now, you got to remember, Daniel is now older. Daniel is not a teenager anymore. I mean, he was there in 605, and now he's in his 80s. I mean, this is where the 70 comes in that I mentioned a little while ago. 70 years. Daniel is now in his 80s. I'm amazed. He wasn't invited to this party. You know why? Because God's people, they don't fit with heathen. Years ago, I had a friend of mine, got out of the will of the Lord, and wanted to get married. Some girl that he knew when he was in junior high school, she wanted to get married. And so they said, let's get married. So he goes, Tommy, I want you to be in my wedding. I said, are you sure? And I said, if that's what you want, I said, you're my friend, I'll be in your wedding. I said, but I'm not going to go to the, you know, rehearsal dinner, because I knew what was going to be there. They were going to be drinking it up. And he said, okay. And he said this, he said, I tell you what, after the rehearsal's over, he said, me and you, we'll go out to eat ourselves, and we'll just let them go do whatever they want to. Now, I bet you, now how well did that go over with the bride-to-be? The groom's wanting to hang out with me. And I said, no. I said, you can get married, man. And he goes, well, you know, she don't want you in the wedding anyway. And I said, but you asked me. And he goes, you know what she said? She said, he doesn't have anything to do with us. He don't like to do the things we like to do. He doesn't like to go to the places. He's different than us. And I smiled at him and I said, that's accurate. That's true. And then they got married and I wished him well. And about less than 6 months later, she was pregnant with another man's baby. And that marriage blew apart. He found another lady. They've been married now for a long, long time. But he left that lifestyle when he was embracing it at one time. Belshazzar. Daniel, you lost your mind? I've heard the stories about that lunatic. He don't drink what we drink. He don't eat what we eat. He's different. And so, what does he do? He says, if you can tell me, his mother's already come in. She's called the queen mother. His mother comes in and said, you know, we got a guy in this kingdom who can tell you this. You know, my daddy, Nebuchadnezzar, he helped him out. He can help you out. And he's old now, but he can still talk. So he comes in. He said, you tell me this and I'll make you number three. Now, what Daniel's about to tell him, that gift meant nothing. It meant nothing. Why? Because it's about over. That very night, it's going to be over. Now, what did he say? I want you to look with me at chapter 5, and I want you to look at verse 25. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. What does that mean? Well, it means this. Mene, mene, that means that your days are basically numbered. In other words, you only have this amount of time left. You don't have any more time. It's over. Tekel, it means you're weighed. They had balances in those days. They would have a weight over here, and they would put gold or silver on this side, and they would weigh to make sure that everything was balanced. Well, here in this situation, he says, thou art weighed in the balance, and you're found wanting. In other words, you think that you're doing well, but you're not. You're about to be shown the great need that you have. And so, the last word is upharsin. Another rendition of that word is used a little bit later in the chapter, and that is perez. But it means that the kingdom's divided. So, your days are numbered, you're found wanting, you're losing your kingdom. That was what the prophet told him. And can I tell you that is exactly what happened? When you finish reading this chapter, verse number 30 says, and in that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans is another word for Babylonians. He was slain. And Darius the Mede took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And how did he do that? You remember that Euphrates River? The one that flowed underneath those bronze gates? Back upstream, you had the Persians, and they began to divert water. And the water level began to go down, 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 down. And before long, it was so low that the army could march underneath the gates of that Euphrates, where it had been high and now it's low. They marched under it. They marched right into Babylon. And in one night, Babylon is gone as far as a world power. And now you have the Medes and the Persians. And ultimately, it'll be the Persians under Cyrus. Two final thoughts. Number one, I want you to remember this. God has you around for a reason. Daniel was there when he was a 16-year-old, and he's there now as an 80-something-year-old. He was there to tell Nebuchadnezzar. Now he is there to tell Belshazzar, the grandson. God has a purpose for you. I don't care how old you are. I don't care how young, how old. God has a purpose for you. And he expects you to fulfill that purpose. Daniel was not a person to be like the world. But when the world got in a pinch, he was the guy that helped them. You may have relatives that you don't know. Chad referenced that a moment ago just before he read the passage out of John 3. He talked about some of the people that he knows that are not saved. When they finally understand, they can see a little bit, who are they going to call? They're going to call you. And when they had a problem, whether it was a dream with Nebuchadnezzar or whether it's the handwriting on the wall with Belshazzar, when they needed help, they got it from God's man. And they will get it from God's people today. That means you and that means me. Number two, I want you to remember this, that God is still in control no matter the situation. Now, I want you to think about this in light of this passage of Scripture that we read. Chapter 4, you have Nebuchadnezzar. For seven seasons, I take that to mean 7 years, God had him crawling around in a pasture. His hair was growing, his fingernails and toenails were growing, and he was eating grass like the beast of the field for seven seasons. Until he finally looked up, and I honestly believe this, I believe when we get to heaven, Nebuchadnezzar will be there. You say, why is that? Because at the end of chapter 4, he began to give glory to God and not to try to seek it for himself. When he was lifted up with pride, God took him down and took him down hard. That's one king. Chapter 5, you see a second king. He was arrogant. He knew the stories of his granddaddy and how his granddaddy had come to follow Jehovah. But he said, not me. I'll live my life like I want to. And you find the demise of a second king, and there's nothing in the scripture that tells us that Belshazzar ever believed in the Lord. But when you get to chapter 6, you're going to find another man named Darius, and he's a king. He's 62 years old at the time that he beats Babylon. And you read about him, every single one of those kings were put up and ultimately taken down by God Almighty. As great as this country is, God set it up, but that same God can take us down if he chooses to. Can I tell you, we ought to run to the Lord as a nation. We ought to run to God as a nation. Beg for forgiveness. Beg for mercy. We're not any more special than some of these old great empires that lived, you know, thousands of years ago. We're not any better. That same God was then. He's going to be there today, and he'll be there tomorrow when we're long gone. And so, these are strange words for a party, but it's sobering words that you and I ought to listen intently to.